Yeah, thank you, Herbert. Actually, this would basically be a blackboard talk, but since we had been looking for nicer weather on Saturday, actually up to the hills, I had some photos as a background for some slides. So there will be some slides, but basically at the very end. So this is here. This is not Black Forest or whatever. This is here. this is Figueroa's mountains. So yeah.
Los Padres.
Los Padres, right, Los Padres forest. Right.
But you end up on Grizzly Peak? What is it called? Sorry. No, this is the
long town. Okay, so that's just the way it looked like.
Yeah, it was really crazy. I mean, okay. So the outline of the talk. Look here. So I will be talking about approximations to the matrix sine function. That's I will particularly emphasize the effect on the precision and how control the accuracy. Then about relaxation of iterative methods in this particular context, since this is where we get the most of the improvements from. This is related to the recursive preconditioning here, and then I will give some numerical results, which will be on the slide. So now I will just switch off the nice photos, but then you will have some more at the end of the talk. So yeah, switch off means hopefully power off, yes. Okay. Okay, so whatever this overlap operator is, for me it looks like this. First of all, I call it D. And okay, so sometimes we must translate between numerical analysis speak and physics. So I is the identity matrix, which would you probably write as a 1. I cannot help it writing an I. But okay. Then you have sine of q times the gamma 5. And the q in our computations was the Wilson kernel. So it was gamma 5 minus Hopping parameter kappa times the Wilson coupling term. Okay. And so the whole thing is that in our computation, we have to solve either dx equal to b, which would be basically for propagator computations, or we would have to solve d squared x equal to b when we have to compute the determinant in a dynamical simulation somehow. So I will address both these. They are related, of course. Well, and the first point in this whole business is the problem with the sine function, the point being that you cannot compute the sine function of a huge million by million matrix. If the matrix is sparse, the sine function will always be full, so you cannot compute it. What you can do, what you can try to do, is when you use an iterative method to solve these systems here, then you only need the action of the sine function on a vector, and that's something you can approximate. Well, so I will set up the general framework, say, and then present some of the results which I think are important in that direction. So the first point is compute sine of q. Well, times a vector, actually, but let's say sine of q. And the one nice thing about the q is that it is Hermitian. This makes things a lot easier. There is the sine function also used in control theory, and they usually have non-symmetric, non-Hermitian matrices, and then the problem gets even worse. What we
may happen also to us.
A non-symmetric kernel in here?
Yeah,
potential. Then, okay. So this would be a real challenge then, because
yeah, whatever okay. They have, mm-hmm. The problems they have,
you are worse. That's what you say. Okay, right, yeah. So right now, when it's symmetric or Hermitian, then you can express the sine function actually as an integral of this kind, q squared plus tau squared I to the minus 1 dt. And basically all the methods that try to approximate the sine function somehow deal on approximating this integral here. And one of the best idea you could have probably is that you can do the following. You apply some creditor rule to this right-hand side, and then you will get the approximation to the sine function as well, 2 over pi times q is always there. And the quadrature rule means that you have weights, omega I, and then you have nodes for the t. So let's call those tau I squared times I to the minus 1, and then you have a sum of, say, 1 to p. Okay? And then that's an approximation because, well, you just evaluated this. Well, you took the value of the integral at certain points, and it should have the right weights here. And one way you can do it is that you take a Gauss rule, so a quadrature rule which is particularly precise. You should do it, well, you don't do it, actually this is of course an infinite integration domain, so that's not so nice, but you can do a Gauss rule once you have done some, variable transformation. If you put the t's like 1 minus t over 1 plus t, then it gets from minus 1 to plus 1, and then you know that the Chebyshev nodes are the right nodes to do the integration. And if you do this, you end up with a formula that Herbert used in the first place when you did your first commutations on the overlap operator. So that's the famous, well, okay. Basically, this goes back to Pandey, Kenney, and Laub in the 90s. So when you do this to express the node detector, I want. It gets back to those. So there's an interesting connection, which is that you can also derive this formula in a completely different way. You iterate on one t plus 1 over t, and then you get the same formula, basically. But okay, well, shouldn't discuss the priority too much. Say, I wanted to mention Kenny because he's here in Santa Barbara, actually. In the electrical engineering department, I guess. Okay. So you can do this, and then you get these approximations. And well, the question, of course, how high has the degree of this quadrature formula to be to get a given accuracy? And it turns out that with these rules, this degree still is quite high. You can end up with 50 poles in that evaluation, and that's quite a lot. And what we came up with some 3 years ago now was to take the Solotarev approximation. So Solotarev is, in a sense, the best you can do anyhow, which means that you find the rational function. So I call it R, say Rz like Solotarev, a rational function. Yeah. So the denominator would be tm plus 1, the denominator 2m. And this rational function would satisfy the following. If you take the infinity norm of any rational function from that space minus the sine function of t, the infinity norm, well, now on intervals of this kind, it's actually sort of something which does not contain zero, so symmetric intervals around zeros. And you want to minimize this quantity, then there's an explicit representation of this rational function which minimizes that. And it looks again like here. So I just don't write it down. It looks like here, but the coefficients are expressed in a different manner. Actually, you need the elliptic functions to express them. But it's doable, and it's explicit, and you can construct it. And what you will see, now, of course, in a sense, this is the best you can do. It's the best you can do in the infinity norm. And as it turns out, to have a given accuracy, the number of poles is definitely decreased quite a lot. So it can go from 40 down to 15, for example. And that comes into the picture. The other point is, of course, is that you have to know somehow bounds for the eigenvalues of the operator. I mean, if you apply this to the operator, then your operator should have its eigenvalues exactly in that range here. So what you always need somehow is an estimate or even bounds on the range of the eigenvalues of that operator. You also need it up here, actually, if you want to know the accuracy of the approximation. That's always an approximation, but if you want to know how good it is, then you have to know where your eigenvalues are lying. Okay, so that's known now, and what I wanted to say now, and that's, I think, is quite important, is how do we do this in practice? So you have these approximations, and you say also you know how good these approximations are. So you know the approximation error. But still now, if it comes to, so you can go over to here. Now it would come to compute something, say, which I call x, which would be sine of q times the vector y. This is what I always have to do when I apply an iterative solver to this one here. So I have to compute this all the time over and over again. And well, if I take one of these rational approximations, then this means that I have to solve, actually, I have to solve, let me see. Okay, let's write it down. So x is equal to the q is here, that's the 2 over pi is here, put it in the coefficient, the q is here, and we have then just this sum, omega I q squared plus tau squared I to the minus 1 times y. So what you do is that you solve systems of the form q squared ti squared I times xi equal to y, and you have p of them, say. Now what is nice about these systems is that q squared is a Hermitian and positive definite matrix, that these shifts here are positive shifts. So as they get larger, the system gets easier to solve. But it's still a huge system, of course. So once more, you will apply an iterative method to solve these systems. And what you do is you apply the CG method, which is always the method of choice for this kind of matrices. And then there's a very nice feature which shows that you can actually solve all these systems at the same time without investing more matrix vector multiplications. That's a crucial issue here. So you solve all those in one step, or basically all P1s of them, step by step. And in each step, you only need one multiplication by Q squared. So this is efficient. Now it is efficient, but of course, if this P is 45, then the other 44 systems you have to work on, where you only do some shuffling of vectors, still matter somehow. And you actually, it turns out that this can be 5 times the load you have just for doing one CG iteration. But basically, that's what is called the multi-shift CG. And it's a nice trick. You need some memory, of course. You need more memory. You have to store vectors for each of the systems. But in principle, it's doable. Well, now the question arises, when do I have to stop these CG iterations? Right now, I have another approximation procedure here. I'm solving these systems. They approximate the sine function. Now I'm solving these systems, and at some point I have to stop. So when do I have to stop? And the question is, can we give some guarantee that when we stop in the right moment, that then we have a certain accuracy? And this turns out, it's a tough question, but it turns out to be quite nice in this sine function context. And that's what I think that's not yet used too much, and I think it's worth looking at. So let me see. When you want to stop, the question is, when stop? And I write this as a theorem, so this might be kind of an exaggeration. I now have these systems here which I want to solve, so I get iterates which I would call xik, so k is the iteration index somehow. If I have those, I can always do this linear combination here, then this would give me, say, a certain global iterate for the linear combination here, which is then the kth iterate as the approximation of the sine function. And the question is somehow, how can I bound xk minus what I really want to have. And now the interesting point is that if epsilon is the approximation of the, let me just say, the rational function, meaning that on the interval where I know that the eigenvalues lie in, I know that this rational expression here approximates the sine function to an accuracy of epsilon in the infinity norm once more. Once I know that, then I know the following, that this difference here is bounded by 1 plus epsilon times the residual RK1. So what is this? If I do the CG iteration on these systems here, then CG always computes residuals, which are, the RK, the kth residual of this here, is just y minus the matrix times the actual iterate. OK? So that's a residual. That's something you will compute anyway, because a CG method runs like that. And that's where you usually would base your stopping criterion in anyway. So what you see here is that, the accuracy we get for the kth iterate is just bound in that manner, and that's a quantity that is computable.
So which residual? You have j different
ones? So it's R1. So it's the one that is corresponding to the first shift. Yeah, right. So
you assume that the taus are ordered.
Implicitly, right. The taus are just ordered. So that for the smallest value here. So the worst one. So it would be the largest one anyway.
But are you assuming that you do the same number of iterations? I guess because of the multi-mass, you do the same number of iterations on all of the multi-mass.
That would be my next theorem, actually. I mean,
if you have to stop for the time, you get underflows, right? If you go.
Yeah, you can get to underflow if you're really unlucky. So you have to stop at some point. So right now this would assume that you just do the same number of iterations for all the systems here, and then the bound is with the residual of the less well-conditioned system. That's true. Yeah, but so still, it's a computable bound. That's a nice point here. Okay, and then the other point is actually, this is not what you would do. You already said you can have underflow problems because the other systems, they will converge so rapidly that you won't have any progress anymore. So there's certainly no use of working on these systems anymore. And you would rather try to stop in an earlier manner. And then the question is, if you do that, can you still again get a global bound on the iterates? And so this would be the second theorem, actually. And it would say the following. So now you have these individual iterates, and you impose a stopping criterion on those, and this would be something of the form, you look for the residuals. So you look for the kth residual of the ith system, and you stop it. Let me check. Right, you stop it, yeah. When you have it smaller than, now that's interesting, 2 times the tau I, so that's the shift, divided by the weight you have, times the epsilon you want, times, say, the number of the systems you have, so 1 over p. So that's the number of systems you're solving, that's the accuracy you want to obtain, and that's a factor you have. So if you stop, so this is the k, say, the stopping. So for the ith system, that's when you stop the iteration. Then again, it turns out that then if you build up an xk, well, it's not an xk anymore somehow. It's an iterate that you build up once you have stopped everything. Okay, right. So it's, call it an x to the minus the solution is again bounded, and nicely enough, just by this epsilon you put in here.
That epsilon is the same as the one for the approximation.
That's not, okay, so here it was the same, here it's not. Okay. So it's any accuracy you choose, actually. Right, yeah. So that's somehow because this is an individual looking at the iterates, and this is the global thing, right? Actually, you can even tune this 1 over p. The only thing is important that you take some coefficient here that sum up to 1. So you could split this differently, but I don't see much of use of taking anything different than the 1 over p's here. So again, these are computable quantities. If you want a given accuracy here, a given accuracy for a solution, that's what the nice thing is, then you know when to stop.
The omega I is the more or less the same order of magnitude for all I?
Not necessarily. They are somehow related to the tau
I's. So
yeah.
What I was just trying to say for a big tau I.
Yeah.
Whether it's not spoiled by
right, the yeah. No, but actually it turns out that this is quite rapidly decreasing actually as the taus get larger. So it's decreasing. So that's, and actually if you do it, then you will find out that if at the beginning you have 20 poles or whatever, very soon you only iterate on the last 5 systems or so. So this is quite a few actually.
For all the different Russian approximations.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with the tariff or whatever. This is true for any.
The tau of omega is rapidly.
Oh, oh, that's it. I don't know. No, it's certainly true for this one because I know them explicitly, and for the tariff ones, it's true too. Otherwise, it's an interesting question, but I don't know. It, yeah, no, I cannot tell you. Of course, if these are always related to a quadrature rule here, then somehow if you get far enough with the tau here on the quadrature rule, then the weight this can get, because this integral converges, the weight will be small. So this is the only thing that, so if, yeah. But okay, I cannot say how this will relate.
The taus get, when the tau is big, then it's easy to satisfy the law. You
right.
Want the taus to increase, not to decrease.
As the I increases, the tau increases, and the whole expression increases. You're right. Yeah, that's what I want to have. Right. Yeah, yeah. I said it the wrong way. That's true. Okay. Well, so I think that's a nice result, because it really, I mean, you're on the safe side, except for rounding errors. Of course, there are still the numerical errors somewhere. But it's nicely controllable to have the sine function accurately computed, which is much better than in the case that you solve it in your system, because there you normally never have a bound on the true error that you're doing. You have only bounds on the residual. Here you have the bounds on the sine function. Okay, so this was part one for the sine function. Some digressions still. I mean, so this was rational functions, but at the very end, what you are doing is you're solving these rational expressions here by applying the Krylov subspace method, which is the conjugate gradient method. So actually, what you are doing is that you build up in the very end your iterate as a function or as a linear combination of at the polynomial in Q times the y you have here. So although there are rational functions here, at the very end, it all comes down to polynomials. And the question is whether you lose something by doing this rational function, or whether it could be better off by taking the best polynomial. And I will show you in the results section that at least experimentally, when you can compute the best polynomial at some point, then you will see that actually this sort of tau comes really very, very close to the best thing. There is a restriction, though, because what you are doing here, if you look at the polynomial point of view, the CG works on Q squared, and there's a Q here. So the expression you get for the X actually is an odd polynomial in Q. So you restrict yourself to odd polynomials, which is maybe not too bad if you want to approximate a sine function. On the other hand, if it happened to be that your right-hand side Y would be such that it contained only modes to positive eigenvalues, then it would be much better to approximate the sine function by the function identical to 1, which is not an odd function. And that you are losing that completely here. You're not doing it. You're not seeing it. You will not see it. It will not happen in the overlap operator. But in a sense, it's a restriction. Okay.
You're not, but that has nothing to do with whether you're doing with a polynomial or this one. You can't.
Well, the polynomial, yes, it does. I mean, there could be, let me just sketch it here. So the restriction here is odd polynomials somehow. And you could, of course, also just take the x as some whatever m degree polynomial times q times the y, whatever way you compute this here. And one of the early Borici papers actually was on doing this with the matrix q rather than q times polynomial q squared, which would be those over here. And they have the potential of fitting better in certain situations, but I don't think in the situations we have here with the overlap operator. But in principle, it could.
If you know that the spectrum is all positive, then of course approximating the sine function by 1 is a very cheap thing to do.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the whole problem in this business is that you never know, and it will never tell you either. I mean, even if it were so that the y would be only on the positive part of the spectrum, you would have to go all through these computations and check once. I mean, you're solving a system, and this doesn't see anything anymore on the signs of the eigenvalues. So you would have to do the whole computation, although you would have nothing to do. But you don't know. It doesn't tell you. That's somehow a problem. So the way you could do this is actually the typical way you work with Krylov subspaces. So you build up the space, which is spanned by y and then qy and so on up to some power, k minus 1 times y, say, or m minus 1 would be then in here. And well, the way you do it, then the nomenclature we have is that you take this as a space, as in the columns. Well, the columns of this matrix here should have an orthogonal basis of this space here. And what you would then do is that you would say X can be approximated by, now you're projecting the Q on this, you're orthogonally projecting the Q. So this is Vm dagger times Vm. And then you just transport everything back. So this would be Vm here and the Vm dagger for the early projection of the Y right here. This would be an approximation. Well, I was missing something. That's a sine function. Okay, so you assign function on the projected system, and then you project back once more. And it turns out that if you do it that way, then the quality of the approximation varies quite a bit. So this is a kind of sawtooth looking thing. So as a function of m, actually, yeah. And so that's why we did not look too much into that. Also, because there is, or at least we couldn't derive an error bound for this kind of thing. On the other hand, what works is if you do it once more in the only in the odd polynomials, in the odd polynomial sense. So here you would do x equal to, now you take u, and then take the same thing here, but then you have not to approximate the sine function, but the inverse square root. So you take the inverse square root of the q squared. And actually, the v's now are built up by the square of such space spent by the q squares and not by the q. If you do it in that way, so that's a Lanczos approximation to the sine function. And there is a result by Jasper van den Essow which tells you once more the quality of the approximation in this situation. So here you can also know the quality of the approximation. This x squared minus x in this situation. Is less than, well, now the residual, which you would call an R0 of the nth iteration. So this is, again, the CG residual, like here, but with a zero shift. So the very worst, in a sense. OK. In the experiments, we also compared this to those over there. And they don't do a lot of, they don't make much of a difference, actually. I show this on the slides as I go on. OK. I know there's Blackboard lunch. How much? Oh, it's half past. OK. So maybe I can. Quantum drums and. Right. OK.
It's not here. It's in
London. Yeah, but. Yeah, OK. Yeah. I should. I probably should be ready by then. Now, the. I think one of the most important contributions that we were able to make is the fact that you should try to do as many cheap approximations to the sine function as you can when you have to solve the system. So now I would like to talk about solving the systems here. Say in the first place, okay, solve either d times, what was my notation, d times x equal to b. Or d squared times x equal to v. Just very rapidly, this d here is a shifted version of a unitary matrix. And there are methods that have been invented by numerical analysis without having any applications in mind that particularly fit this problem. And when I told this to my friend Lothar, who invented this method 10 years ago, he was very happy to see that at the end there is something that really needs this. So, so this tells you that you should sometimes also do things that do not yet have an application. I mean, so there are optimal methods, optimal Krylov subspace methods, iterative methods for this kind of systems. And for this, since this is once more a symmetric positive definite, you just take the CG method. So maybe we should talk about basically about CG now. But we could also talk about this other method, which we finally called the symmetric unitary minimum residual, because it has a minimum residual property somehow. So these are just methods, say. OK, now the important point is, if you do this Krylov subspace methods, you have to multiply, when you build up the, when you do the method, you have to multiply with the matrix D. But the matrix D contains the sine function. So you have to do exactly these computations here. And the question now is, how precise do they have to be? Intuitively, you would say, if I want a precision epsilon at the very end, then my matrix vector product should be as least as precise. To be on the safe side, I would say 10 times better or whatever. And yeah, and at the end also, I would say, yeah, in the end, so is there a way I can save on things? And now, in the first side, counterintuitive thing is that, well, at the beginning, you have to be very accurate, and at the end, you can be sloppy. Yeah, that was counterintuitive to many people at some. But actually, I think for physicists, it should not be really a problem because it's just a matter between relative and global accuracy, right?
Well, because you could also do an inner doing part. You could just keep instead of taking the absolute errors, you take the relative error, you take the absolute error.
Right, that's the same thing. Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So. I prepared the. If that's immediately clear, then there's maybe nothing more to say. But I prepared some. I mean, if you look at some simple methods in the first place, then you would understand how this really works out. So maybe I can. Should I do that? Yeah. Okay. So let me. So I don't take. Well, so okay. Let's say the matrix is A right now. It must not be. It's any matrix, say. And the problem is that you cannot accurate A times a vector accurately. Okay. And we do a very simple iteration, which in mechanics we call the Richardson iteration, which works as follows. So if AX should be B, then this is of course equivalent to X is equal to I minus A times X plus B. And if you want to iterate, then you just do it in this way. Okay, well, we don't do it in this way, actually, because you want to have a measure of the error also, so we rather update the residuals, and it turns out that the residuals are updated in this manner, and then xk plus 1 is just xk plus the rk. So actually, I should twist this so that this is in the right way. So you're correcting the current iterate by the residual, and then you're updating the residual in that manner. Okay. And the point is still that I cannot do this multiplication here accurately. So what I'm doing in fact is that I have new iterates. So I give them again the twiddle, r twiddle k, and the r twiddle k plus 1 is now I minus a times the r twiddle k, well, plus the error I'm doing. So I cannot do it accurately. So I'm introducing just a vector which accounts for the fact that a times r is not correct. Okay. And then what you can do in this simple situation is that you just check out how the difference between the iterates and the residuals as compared to the exact ones looks like. And I think it's very simple. So r twiddle minus r, you get something which is a sum of the powers of the I minus a, so that the ith power to k probably, and what you have here is the sk minus I. Okay, so this gets just multiplied upon that. And then if you look at the difference between the x's, you just have to sum up all the differences between the residuals, okay? But the point is, if you want this residual to be close to the residual you have here, and you have conversions of the method, which means that the norm of this here is less than 1, say, so convergence of the method means that anyway we will assume that the norm of this is less than some alpha less than 1, then you will always find that the difference in the residuals is bounded by, well, 1 over 1 minus alpha times a beta. If beta is the accuracy, I mean, so if the norm of the sk minus I are all less than beta. Okay? So this does not really depend on the iteration length anymore. I just have it in this manner, but since this method converges, and if I want my error, my residual, be small somehow, I just have to take the beta in the order of magnitude of the accuracy I want to get. Okay, right. So that's fine, but that's an absolute number. That's the point. So the accuracy I want to have on the S is an absolute number, 10 to the minus 10, say. But where does it come from? It comes from here. It comes from the fact that when I apply A to the R twiddle here, I make this error. The R twiddle goes to 0, 2. So I have an absolute bound on this one. And if I do, for example, my sine function approximation business, then I always, in the principal way, at least in the first point, I would look for a relative accuracy, of course. But what this tells you is that you can increase the relative accuracy because you need only an absolute accuracy here. That's the basic point. Or that's the whole point. But of course, this was an analysis for an easy to implement, an easy-minded method. And you would have to do all this for the other more fancy methods. And what turns out is actually that you can quite well suggest which strategy to choose for the beta here, for the accuracy of the on how to evaluate the function. And this turns out to be, you can take this off. So for final accuracy of epsilon, say, if I'm doing this SUMR method, or what is very familiar, of course, it's the GMRath method, then you should do the following. The accuracy should be proportional or actually equal to epsilon over the norm of the current residual. So that's just turning absolute into relative accuracies. For the CG, it turns out that it's better to do it in the following manner. You have to sum over all of the RJs, J equal 1 to K squared, and then 1/2. So there's this rather two norm of all the errors you had in here. This comes up from a more detailed analysis, I would say, some 100 pages in the thesis of Jasper, actually. So that's not that that intuitive anymore, but then it's completely justified theoretically. So that's how you should do. Okay, so what happens now is that definitely you know that you can relax the accuracy for the sine function approximation as the iteration goes on. And if you plot the standard plot, say the number of iteration here, and up here the log of the accuracy, say of the error or of the residual, then what will happen is that your CG method, say, converges like that. And if you do the relaxation, then it just looks exactly the same way. You really don't see it, except that at some point, you must have something like that, which means that your true accuracy you get because you fixed some accuracy epsilon for the whole method cannot be further increased. You will not see it because the CG method itself will tell you that it's still increasing, so that it's still decreasing. So you have to check this once more. But this point is very precisely at the accuracy epsilon that you have been chosen beforehand. If you plot it in the other direction, or in another graph, where now here you put the number of, I just call this matrix vector multiplications. So the work you have to invest because you're doing cheaper approximations at some point. This would be a right scale rather than the number of iterations. Now, then without relaxation, it still looks like this. And with the relaxation, you will see that as your iteration goes on, you will have less work to invest. So this plot does not look too great, actually, because what you're saving in this plot is just some 5%. And this is what actually somehow also happens. I mean, it is not yet that much. This has to do with the fact that what you really save in terms of matrix vector multiplications corresponds, in a sense, to the part of this area as compared to the whole area in the plot here. And since Kudrow subspace methods have the tendency to converge superlinearly, this is bad in that situation. Okay? So in order to be really good, what you would like to have now is no superlinear convergence. It would be much nicer. It would be much nicer if convergence were like this, because then what you save is a more substantial part. And that's actually more. I tell you how. That's the whole point. I mean, so that's the final idea now. So really, you want to make converge it faster. Actually, well, you always want to make converge it faster and linearly. And how do I make it converge faster? Well, that's through preconditioning. That's always. If you ask a neural analyst and you tell him my iterative method is not fast enough, then he says, well, why don't you do preconditioning? The point, of course, is you have to know how to do it. Preconditioning, in the classical sense, means that you approximate the system matrix that you want to solve with by something which you can invert more easily, and they invert this in every step. And then you get faster convergence. Of course, we don't know. Well, we still cannot invert anything because we still have the sine function in there. So we would not know how to do this. But what we can do is that, well, we can do in each step a cheap inversion of the whole system already. You see? A cheap inversion of the system. So we're solving this system, which we want to solve by our iterative method. We use a preconditioner, which already solves our system, but only to an accuracy of 10 to the minus 1, say. Okay? That's cheap. And since we know, so if the accuracy we want to have at the very end is 10 to the minus 1, the approximation to the sine function we want to have is also only 10 to the minus 1. So we need, it's much cheaper to do the sine function on that. So I think I just would try like to draw a picture how this looks like. In the first place, we have here something which computes sine of q times b, which is our favorite rational function approximation, say. And then we have our overall methods, which I call the outer iteration. This outer iteration in each iterative step has to apply the sine function somehow. So this goes in this direction. And what we do in the first place is that we do relaxation here, relaxation. Okay, relaxation meaning that the accuracy I have is something like epsilon over RK. Okay. So this is all nested. This is already nested somehow because we're doing iteration here to do the sine function and there's the outer iteration here. But now we nest it even on the third level, which is the preconditioner. So here we do preconditioning. And we have some other method. So this will be the preconditioner. And this is the inner iteration. And it has very low accuracy. That's the most important point. No accuracy. So what I need from here is only a low accuracy evaluation of the sine function here. So here I have, say, epsilon equal 10 to the minus 1. Doesn't change. We did some experiments. 10 to the minus 1 was just fine. Okay, so the whole thing is, of course, more complicated. But and you also have to know which methods to take. So for the inner iteration, we take CG. If we are in the squared context here, you just take CG. So you solve this inner iteration by CG. You only need 5 or 10 CG iterations. And all those with cheap evaluations of the sine function. But they give you somehow as a preconditioner an additional accuracy of 10 to the minus 1 up here. And if you want to go to 10 to the minus 10 only, then you only need 10 iterations up here. And these iterations so need only 10 times a call to the sine function here. And only in the very first times you need this really accurately. That's the whole point. There's a point also that now you have to be careful because this is not a classical preconditioning step once more. It's a more flexible one because you're preconditioning by an iterative solver. So you cannot take the CG method up here, but something which is called GMRES recursive, because in a sense you're doing recursive applications of your own method within its, in the method itself. But this is something that can be described, and it's in one of our papers, and we also have meta code on all this on our website, actually. Okay, so that's why nested is threefold nested. Outer, inner, and then the rational function approximation which goes into both.
You need to use a CG for the cost. You can use a polynomial
there. Here?
Yeah.
Well, this is not only the sine function approximation, but I'm really solving the whole system here to a low accuracy, so I have to take a solver somehow. Yeah.
Sorry. How do you iterate? How do you increase the precision or the decrease the
Okay, so
start with say epsilon 10 to the minus 1. Come over here and you do outer.
Okay, so I start with outer.
Yeah, what do you do then?
So the outer first calls the preconditioner in the the outer first calls the preconditioner. Mm-hmm. The preconditioner solves the system with the current residual, whatever it is applied to a given fixed precision 10 to the minus 1. Okay, then you have to recalculate the residual of the outer iteration. There you have to compute the sine function once more. And when you do this, then the accuracy is relaxed by this method here. So if the residual in the beginning is large, then it's to your precision you want to. Then comes the next step. Your residual, well, you need the precondition once more. It's fixed accuracy, so fixed work. It's get already quite a bit faster. So this might now be already 10 to the minus 2. So epsilon over this is 100 times more. So you can do already a more sloppy approximation of the sine function in there. And that's how it shuffles itself around. And So of course, in a sense, you are cheating. If you, you're not really cheating, but if you look at the numbers of multiplications with the matrix Q, you're hiding a lot in this preconditioning step here. But this is only valid or only really a gain because this preconditioning step must be cheap, and then the sine function can be applied cheaply. So we are saving always on that part here. And now it's really true. I mean, if you compare the pictures, and this is what I will do now from the with the slides, is that it goes down very steeply, and that's why you gain. You gain in the end a factor of between 3 and 4, but that's not too bad actually, I think. And
why couldn't you use the preconditioner in a CG loop instead of that GM res?
Recursive, yeah. So I mean, classical preconditioning means that you have the matrix A and you have a preconditioner which is M. And then you have to, in the iterative method, you're solving. So you're applying M to the minus 1. Okay, if you have all this, there are some implicit relations between residuals and iterates and search direction vectors and so on, which are used in the formulation of CG. The point is now that I don't have explicit a matrix. I'm doing some iteration with a stopping criterion.
The conditioner keeps changing.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah. That's the point, yeah. There's also something called flexible GMRES, which is quite the same than this recursive thing here, which can deal with this. Okay. Yeah, the preconditioner is changing. Not too much, but it is changing, so it's better. Okay?
Can you accommodate multi masses on the algorithm?
On the very outer level, you mean? This would be the fourth level of nesting, but okay. So I mean, my first answer is yes, but don't ask me how I would do it exactly. But I think as long as it means that I can find a way of doing my other masses here by recurring to the masses I'm doing here, that's fine. The point would be that the accuracy requirements I have everywhere must adjust to each other. So we must see this. Okay. So just some of the results.
So you did not do multi-mass on row?
No, not yet, maybe.
Well, I
mean, that's an interesting suggestion. I never thought about this.
So well, you probably want to do multi-mass on the outer one, even in the dynamical case, for different reasons.
You like
the masses and
the
balanced masses
are
different
than
the
C
masses.
No, because I want to use more than one
two
binomial field.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah,
Philippe?
Oh. You don't have out.
No, so actually, in our computations, we do. So the results I will show you project out low-lying eigenmodes, because this, in addition, helps a lot. It helps an awful lot, actually, I must say. This will be on my last slide here. Maybe because the pictures are so nice, I turn off the lights. It's OK. no pictures. But this was on approximating the sine function. This was a plot on a 16 to the 4 lattice, right here at the parameters. And what you see here is the following. In a sense, we did one fake, which is that from the Krylov subspace being built up, not with odd polynomials, but with whatever polynomial, we computed the best approximation. Once we knew the solution, so we just computed this back. And so the best approximation is just the bottom line in here all the time, OK? Then what you see here, that's the method that we all use. That's with the Zolotarev rational approximation. So it comes this way here, OK? This rugged thing here, that's when you do the Lanczos approximation with Q, not with Q squared. So it keeps going up and down all the time, and we don't have an error estimate for this. Although, at the very end, it seems to be much closer to the optimal one, at least every second step, say, than the other ones. Well, it's every even step. I mean, you know which one it is. But, we would say that... This has to do with the fact whether, right.
Who cares
Okay, well, it's every other step, say. Well, no, well, who cares? I mean, because that's only experimental findings. Oh, yeah. The other point is that there's theory about it. And I think that's better on the safe side, yeah. This here, by the way, is if you do some Chebyshev approximation with Chebyshev expansion, and this is clearly way off.
So when you say Chebyshev, that's the Chebyshev polynomials, or is it Chebyshev polynomial expansion?
Chebyshev polynomial expansion, I guess. So this is what Hansen and Lelouch and Hernandez did, I think.
Yeah. This uses a Chebyshev polynomial. It approximates the function by series and TNs.
Right, exactly. So, to a given degree.
It's not there for the optimal polynomial approximation satisfying Chebyshev's theorem.
No. Oh no. Okay. No. So right. It's L2 stuff. It's not L infinity stuff. Say somehow. Yeah. Yeah. It's evaluation in the numerical recipes. Okay. So here we go back. So this was just one study about the poles you need for a given accuracy, which happened to be 10^-6 in the case. It depends on the condition of the matrix Q. So if you go from 200 to 1,000, already this Pende, Kenny, and Laub grows from 19 to 42, which is quite a lot. There was a paper by, this is Edwards, Heller, and Narayanan, who did this with the Remes algorithms, but on the wrong function, say. They did the Remes for the 1 over the square root. And you see that this still is augmenting, whereas the Solitar, as well, it also has to go up, but it's quite a bit fewer. And so we did this on several configurations in a dynamic simulation on NS, where, so configurations from 1 to 5. This is still approximating the sine function, and you're comparing. So this was the Lanczos approach with Q squared. This is the Pendekin and Laub. This is Solotarev without removal, and this is Solotarev with early removal, which means what we just discussed, that you have a way to stop the iteration on those systems that have already converged with a given accuracy. So that's a safe side thing too. But you save, so you save on you save on the additional systems you have to solve. So you don't save matrix vector multiplications. Actually, if you compare, you see that you are doing some more, but you have less systems to work on, so the overhead per system is reduced. And in terms of seconds, which is the lines we have here, this pays out quite a lot. So from 102, we get to 79. The problem with the Lanczos approximation is that you have to do a two-pass, because in the Lanczos approximation, you have to save all the Lanczos vectors to retrieve your final iterate. And so if there is 1,769 matrix vector multiplications, then actually this is just, this plus 1 is 2 times this over here. So this, there's a very close correspondence. And but of course, the timings are coming actually quite close. So if you had enough memory to just store all the to store 1,000 Lanczos vectors, this would actually be the method of choice, which is also safe from a circuit point of view. So you would do this one here because you don't have to work on the additional systems. That's the whole point of here.
Okay. So your time is basically proportional to the number of times you apply Q or no?
Well, actually, that's the point. It would be nice if this were so, but due to the shifted systems, I would say every 4 or 5 shifted systems are as much as 1 multiplication by Q. Okay,
so the higher number was basically the Q applications?
You mean?
Matrix.
Yeah, these are matrix vector multiplications, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, what you see is, on the other hand, if you do the Solotarev approximation or if you do the other Pende, Kenny, and Laub approximation to the function, and then you do the multi-shift CG, at the very end, you end up with almost always the same number of matrix vector multiplication. So in a sense, they are combining the iterates in the right manner to get you a good approximation to the sine function. The whole point being that here you need 45 poles, and here you need only, 18. So the overhead you have for the additional system is very substantial. It's a factor of 2. Yeah, the quality is as good. Matrix vector applies are the same, but the work on the additional systems is what kicks you out here. So the best is to do the early removal, or the very best would be to have enough memory to do the Lanczos, in my opinion.
Andre, I don't understand your statement. When you say that there were 4 or 5 shifts, is equivalent to a multiplication of Q?
In times.
This 2%. Because this is only addition of memory, unless you have a memory issue.
Yeah, well,
just
I mean.
One addition all the masses.
Just one scalar product.
Yeah.
Scalar product is
what, on the Perry machine?
The same thing, it's just a ship. It's just a mass. Yeah, it's a scalar multiply.
Constant times
a vector.
Yeah, but I mean, it's at least three or four, I would say, combinations of vectors. And then you have, to, I mean, if you do the multiplication with a Wilson term, right, then this is not, I don't have the precise way, but I thought it would be not much more than, say, 20 to 30 matrix, sex-p operations, for example, to apply the,
The overhead is very, very low, less than 10%. Right. Taking 20 masses. Put the, 14 or 15 solar tariff terms.
Depends on the memory bandwidth.
That's right, that's the memory.
This could be another.
More than the just operations.
Yeah, could be. But of course, I mean, the shift is not just one vector operation. This is three or four, if I remember well.
Two extra. You've got to update the solution, the shift solution vector and the shift direction vector for the MCU.
Okay, so this, yeah, and then you have to. Yeah, okay, yeah, so that, right. Okay, well, I'm sure we did quite a good implementation here. So maybe the number of poles is also even quite a bit more substantially. Anyway, the method of choice is sort of tasked with a remover, that's for sure. Or if you could afford it, a lunches, in my opinion.
This double pass thing.
So this is just a sine function. So we now can come to the, you mean for solving the system? Double pass or what?
Double pass for the sine function.
For the sine function.
I'm not sure to know what it is.
Well, you save the memory.
Oh, okay. Well, now I see. So this is double pass here. This is double pass. This is double pass. So that's why this is just twice as many as over here. So this is double pass, exactly. Yeah. So you're building up the tridiagonal matrix from which you get the sine function approximation, right. And then you build up the Lanczos vectors once more. Right. So this is not with extremely large memory. So this is double pass due to memory restrictions.
So you before said that there was a double pass, there isn't.
Well, in this implementation, there isn't, but I would like to divide this by two by investing memory. That's what I want.
Got you.
Yeah?
Okay.
But the Lanczos one, you can also use the removal, right? Can you do it? If you double pass, and then you can use the removal, and then it will be as fast as the lowest one.
Yeah.
In the Lanczos, I don't do removal.
But you could combine removal with double.
Yeah, pass. Yeah. With the double pass, you can do the removal. So if you use a Lanczos, okay, then you may not be able to do the removal explicitly. But then if you use the double pass with removal, okay.
I don't think we talk about the same method in this case, because Lanczos is not as a linear equation solver where I would have to have a family of 50 systems.
I think that when you say double pass, what you mean is that you just go through and recreate the Krylov space again.
Right.
Whereas I think when you're talking about double pass, when you're discussing the method for doing the multi-shift.
Yeah.
So I think they're different sorts of
multiple parts. Right. Because, I mean, this Lanczos here is not doing a series of equation solvers on shifted systems. It's just, as I wrote it down, well, it's not here anymore. But, yeah, there's still a double pass. I'm building the Lanczos vectors twice.
But can't you do a double pass with one of the solar power with removal? In the sense that you calculate twice the vectors.
I could do this here also, but I mean there's no need for it unless you would have many shifts. If memory would be an issue, yeah, so then I could do this. Could do this here, yeah.
I think the point is that if you go to high order, say. 64 or even higher, okay, then the double pass certainly
will but be necessary once you can answer. Yeah,
in this case, you only have the single pass, right?
That single pass.
Seems to me that addition is very costly. Okay. much costly than using the double pass.
It is the same thing that you observed, but it's that relatively speaking, multiple actions of Q are less expensive relative to the other stuff we have.
Okay, all right.
So therefore, when you do a double pass, you pay only in Q actions. Actually, you save in the
other. In the additional, right, okay.
And he will work it out for some balances.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a. I mean, here talking of a two-pass two because you're generating the whole space twice.
Absolutely.
But so that's a different. Yeah, so it's the same idea, but it's not the same, quite the same thing, right?
But in terms of fitting in the cache, for example, may make a difference. When you think about memory.
Right. This could be this. Yeah, this might make a big difference. Yeah, it would also maybe explain why these additional systems can be so expensive in this situation. That's, let me come to the other plots. So this is the plot for the this is standard CG on the squared overlap operator equation, and I plot the residual norm against the number of multiplications with the Dirac matrix. Okay, and then you see. So this is without relaxation. This is what you gain by doing relaxation. Okay, and now this is what you gain by doing this recursive. So realm is relaxation, you gain this, and this is by applying it recursively. So this is the full picture over there. And that's the additional gain you get. Well, this is for small lattices, and it's for a very large value of mu. Well, mu is related to this, you cannot read it probably here. It's a trivial to the picture. So rho, the parameter over here, is 1 plus mu by 1 minus u. So that's a very, very large value for the mu. And actually, what turns out, if the mu gets smaller, well, usually you over make the lattice larger. And a typical picture would look like this. So the difference is that now here you're below 8, whereas at the beginning you have been at 18. So the factor becomes more than 2. And if you go to larger lattices this and to smaller values of mu, the tendency is in the right direction. So yeah, I can see, I don't have plots for this, but I do have numbers. So this, just to say that this also works for this SUMR method, not only for the CG method. So if you're doing propagator computations, it's once again the same thing. By the way, this is every time you have a tick here, this is when you have finished an auto iteration. So the whole procedure here with the recursive thing does only 6 or 7 iterations, auto iterations, where the others do 20 or even 30 auto iterations. That's the basic thing. Yeah. Okay. Of course, this other one does for each iteration also such a preconditioning iteration, which is cheap. So let's go forward once more and look for the numbers here. So this was mu equal to 0.1 on 8^4 configurations. And so we now plot the gain over CG. So you see, this was in dynamic simulation. And the gain is between 3.2 and 3.7. So it comes close to a factor of 4. And actually, if you go to the 16.4 to the lattices.
This is with projection.
Oh, this is always with projection. That's my final slide, actually. This is with projection, yeah. you need the projection, otherwise I don't think you can go on. So this was on a 16^4, it was only quenched, but we tried smaller values for the mu in this situation. And what you see is as the mu gets smaller, the method becomes more and more efficient. So in this is the situations where the relaxation doesn't give you that much, only a factor of 1.6, but the recursive thing gives you an additional factor of more than 2.5, so that's 4.3 at the very end. So it scales. As problems become more difficult, the improvement is better. So that's something we were quite happy with. Santa Ynez Valley, by the way. The same. Well, now, once, instead of taking CG in here, we took this SUMR method, but then you have to apply it twice because you have the squared system. And so took this as a solver in here. And it turned out, but this is something we still have to investigate more, that for the smaller values of mu, we actually get smaller runtimes. You have to compare these 5,900 here with the situation where we took the CG method as the iteration. This was up here, which was 6,600. So there's an additional gain, but we're not yet that sure about where this comes from and whether it will really last. But there's a potential. And now the final slide is the point that all this was done by projecting out low eigenmodes and actually not that that few of them on the 16th, on the 8 to the 4 lattice with mu equals 0.1, we found, for example, that it was optimal to project out about 30 of the lowest eigenvalues. So here's the total time.
This is quenched.
This is certainly quenched, yeah. I cannot tell you really. I mean, as long as I'm computing the determinant and I'm taking this, then I think it still speeds up the computation of the determinant. But
no, it's the other way around. It's the other way around. Usually, it's worse. It's worse. You know, it's a whole lot worse.
Yeah, yeah. That's the problem. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the major issue of this one. I don't know.
Also, yeah. I mean, it's usually, you know, stated in terms of M residual being worse at a given approximation.
When you don't project.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. So that means there's more crap there to do it.
So I mean, here I'm talking about the projection just for doing the linear solver, anyway. So, but it turns out, I mean, if you see the timings here, it's more than a factor of 10 if you do some of the 20, 25, 30 projections out there, and so it's very vital to do that.
So the projection by itself buys you more than all the tricks that you explained
before. The point is that our tricks come in addition. Yeah, so if the projection gives you a factor of 10, then our tricks gives you a factor of 4, then you're up with a factor of 40.
But what I'm trying to say is the optimizing the number of eigenmodes to project might be a crucial.
No, but then you come to a place where there's a wall, there's a whole lot of eigenmodes coming to a very short range. So there's a small number, there's a very few small numbers that are very small, so it's worthwhile coming up from the start at
Is that true in the, what happens with that state?
I think this is true in the Gaussian Fermi. Well, I don't know for sure.
No, the wall?
I don't know about the overlap, domain wall type of
thing.
But isn't this going to get worse with a larger volume lattice? You're going to have more and more to project.
That's
exponentially, it's going to. Robert did this at scale, right? The exponential square root of the volume.
There's a compensation fixed that is correct, but you also change that.
Higher physical there's an exponential for square root of volume plot. I think it's either lattice or something. Also the lattice phase. Both beta and volume.
But the continuum of the problem goes away, so something is logical.
I don't know how the functional form looks like. It just goes with the.
If you declare in advance that your objective is to do a 10 fermion. Then eventually, by making the lattice finer, this problem goes away.
I understand. But if I take the same physical volume, I discretize it more, and that is less than, that's right. But it's worse if you have the larger lattice space. Yeah. It's worse. The problem is much worse with the lattice space, even if you have a small lattice volume, but same physical volume. That's how we did for Fermi's.
I mean, anyway, the projection of the eigenmodes is always a business that puzzles me somehow, because it so much depends that you only have a few of them. I mean, if you would have to project out 1,000 eigenvalues because they are all so close to zero, then you cannot do it anymore. And but of course, here it helped really an awful lot.
But that's the problem with full QCD. Basically,
Gage
actually doesn't control much.
Not as much,
yeah. All right. Well, that was it.
I just have one.